Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Vinyl Guide Podcast. Today we are going to be talking with Michael Girard of Swans. Michael joins us to discuss the new album from Swans, Leaving Meaning, which is available for pre-order at younggodrecords.com. You got to get there quick. There's a pre-sale happening now. It's a 2-LP set, only $25. It's in extremely limited numbers. It comes with a poster, a special insert, and signed by Michael. All that for $25. So I recommend you point your browser to younggodrecords.com and get a copy for yourself before they're gone. Now, Swans is a very interesting band. I won't begin to attempt to describe them, as any words I say will likely fall short and be deservedly undermined by some of the recordings in their vast catalog. What I will say is this: there is no band like Swans. They are as unique as can be. And Michael, being the producer and nucleus of Swans, is equally inimitable. The new LP, Leaving Meaning, is a next step for Swans. And Michael shares today on how that album came together, how the record leverages a cast of musicians selected for each song by Michael, who creates a path for each of them to contribute to the arrangement and material. Michael also shares how he writes material, how he moves through the creative process and develops works like Leaving Meaning. There's beauty, there's darkness, sometimes both in Swan's music. So again, younggodrecords.com, Leaving Meaning pre-order, 2-record autograph set. Do it now. Now, here on the Vinyl Guide Podcast, I do not run ads. I won't try to sell you a mattress or a website. However, I do need to eat. So I've set up a Patreon page at patreon.com/vinylguide, where I put a lot of extra material, additional bits from interviews, secret episodes, and more. So if you like what I do here, please help me get a few tacos this month by joining our Patreon community at patreon.com/vinylguide. And your patronage to the show is appreciated. And with that, let's talk to Michael Girard of Swans. Hello, is this Michael?
Yes, you're coming through loud and clear. Is it Nate or Nat?
Nate. Thanks for
asking. Nate. Hello, Nate.
How are you, Michael?
I'm jet-lagged in Moscow. I'm doing okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Hopefully you've got a cup of coffee there. It's morning in Moscow, I would imagine, yeah?
It's noon.
Noon. Okay.
You don't sound Australian. Are you American?
Originally from America, but I've lived here in Australia for almost 20 years now.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah. It's one of the best decisions I've ever made in my life. You get down here to Australia that much?
Yeah. Let me see. Like 3 times, I think, now.
Okay. Is there going to be a 4th soon?
I don't know. We have a Swans itinerary worked out for next year, but so far I don't see Australia on the scheme.
Oh, there's always hope. So, Michael, I've been listening to the new album the last week. I want to let people know the new album from Swans, Leaving Meaning, is available for pre-order at younggodrecords.com. And in getting into the album, it really feels to me, seems to signal a bit of a transition. You've got a new band, new sounds, what appears to even be a new type of cover art. Am I recognizing this correctly, or am I imagining things?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, first of all, on the record, it's not really a band. I gathered people that I've known over the years, some of whom were all of the members of the previous incarnation of Swan also play on the record. But I also gathered musicians that I had met over the years, either on tour or just through other friends or something. Mm-hmm. And I decided to, rather than go into the studio with a fixed cadre of individuals, I decided to ask people to contribute just based on what the song itself required and how I could sculpt that song into a little piece of cinema using other musicians. So I chose people whom I like personally and whose musical aptitude might be likely to surprise me. Mm. So that's what happened.
Yeah, because the album, the personnel, the musicians, there's some familiar names there. Larry's there and a few other folks that you've worked with in the past. And it seems to be somewhat curated. There seems to be quite a quite a cast of contributors here.
Yeah, well, it's my misfortune to not only be the artist, but also the producer. So, I mean, the producing records is part of the way I shape the music, the songs themselves, too. So I just gathered, I tried to be a little dispassionate and gathered the people that I thought would serve the song the best.
Hmm. So, for instance, the distance between your demos and the final recordings is quite interesting. A song like It's Coming, It's Real, the demo is a solitary guitar and a voice, but the album version has very prominent background vocals, almost a doo-wop style, you know, in a throbbing drum beat. Is that, do you have that vision for the final recording when you did the acoustic demo, or was that a product of pre-production or studio collaboration?
Well, when I write songs on an acoustic guitar, well, first of all, I kind of feel them in my belly because the guitar is pressed up against my belly, and I play with strumming with my thumb, which makes it kind of a bassy instrument. And I can kind of feel the resonance of the chords, the open style of chords that I play. And I can also hear the overtones from the chords that I'm playing. And I usually think about how to make those overtones more prominent through the addition of other musicians. Of course, there's rhythm things involved as well. But I'll have a color or a trajectory, I guess, to use a more pragmatic term, in my mind. And then once I start working with other people, inevitably things change. And then I just act as kind of a arbiter or a ringmaster, trying to shape the way things are going. I don't just sit down with people and just say, oh, play whatever you want. But what they play when it surprises me is usually when it's best.
You leave the room for those delightful surprises.
Yeah, well, I mean, I gather people because I want their input. I don't want them to be automatons. So, I mean, I want them to bring their creative force to the music as well.
That's interesting. You mentioned color. When you're in a creative mood, when you're creating these songs, do you envision a literal color in your mind?
No, I just use that word because everything else seems to be inadequate. It's, for instance, I have a notion of how the next record will sound, and it's just based on, I don't know, just kind of a resonance that I want. Mm-hmm. And I'll just follow my instincts until it seems right.
The opening tracks on Leaving Meaning, I've got the impression, I mean, very cinematic. There was orchestral production, which immediately to me suggested a new direction. Is there a story or a narrative, or how intentional is the sequencing of the record?
Oh, it's always very intentional. Of course, these days it's a moot point because it gets all shuffled around on the internet. But it's not that I wrote the songs to be in a certain sequence. It's just once the things start coalescing, it's obvious how one thing affects the perception of the next thing. And that's very important, the dynamics and the context of the material.
There's a few songs that appear to be missing on the vinyl version. I think Some New Things is a digital-only track, and some of the songs seem to be shortened or truncated to be able to fit on vinyl. How do you make those decisions? Is that difficult for you?
Yes, it was very painful, but it's necessary. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't want to put more than 20 minutes on a side because then the audio quality is less. So I had to cut certain things. It's just how it is. But fortunately, people who buy the vinyl can get the digital download as well. And I guess through toggling back and forth, maybe they can get a perception of what the music's like. I don't know.
Right. But that's difficult for you to say, okay, well, this is the song. I'm going to cut these pieces out. How do you make that decision?
Well, you know, I on the last in, during the last tenure of Swans, from 2010 to 2017, I didn't make those decisions. I just said, I don't care, and let the music just, I mean, some of the songs are 30 something minutes long. And if they happen to end up on the end of a side of vinyl, I would just fade down, mm-hmm. fade down during the song, and then fade it up at the beginning of the next song.
Like an old 8-track.
Yeah, something like that. But just, I didn't want to put out another triple album. So I was kind of forced to do some incisive cutting.
Mm-hmm. Is the physical media of music something you pay a lot of attention to?
How do you mean? You mean the way in which it's presented? Received?
Yeah, well, the way it's presented. For example, I mean, a lot of the world right now seems to be quite happy with the streaming model. But with you and the releases on Young Gods, there seems to be a focus on the physical music media, CDs and vinyl.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, we're in on through those other mediums as well. But yeah, that's my preferred notion. I've always appreciated the kind of tangible quality of packaging and the way that the kind of tension that exists between an image or even the tactile quality of the thing in your hand. Mm-hmm. And the music and how that kind of rubs against it and makes you perceive it perhaps in a different way. That just comes from being, when I was young, having records and staring at the images while I listened to the music, and it just kind of opened up a whole world.
Mm. There seems to be a relation with not only just the physical media and your music, but also across multiple releases. For example, Glowing Man and To Be Kind, they almost seem like brother and sister sort of packaging, very similar, even the spines. Is that something that you that is important to you?
Well, I mean, I've been making music for decades, and you develop a certain iconography or certain tropes, and they need to carry through from one to the other for continuity. So that's what I do. I mean, it just makes sense. I mean, this new album, The Physical Thing, is also on the rough cardboard that was used in the last previous two records. And it just makes sense to me. It just feels like it ties the work together.
I think it was late last year you released a book, The Egg. What connections does The Egg have to this new LP, if any?
Yeah, I don't really know if it has any. I guess it's the same author, but it's a completely different world. The stories are kind of recondite, you know. They're a little obtuse and obscure. And I guess with music, I have to be more direct in certain ways.
Because it feels like there's the very similar tactile properties of the book as there are to the CD.
Oh, you mean the physical presentation? Yeah. Yeah, well, that's just an affinity I have for that way of presenting things visually.
Yeah, there seems to be a very consistent theme in some of these, and that's why it's very interesting to me. Almost like I get the impression, again, let me know if I'm seeing something that's not there, but there seems to be similar aesthetic properties in clusters, like Glowing Man, To Be Kind, even Leaving Meaning. They seem to have those same physical properties. White Light, Love of Life, those had very similar covers. There seems to be like almost phases that you you have those sort of visual aesthetics.
Yeah, I guess that's natural. I mean, mm-hmm. I'll use an idea until it's not worthwhile anymore, then I'll move on to something else.
The new LP, it seems to be shorter than some of your previous works. Was there any thinking on this point? Was just how it turned out?
Both. Mm-hmm. These are discrete songs that were written on acoustic guitar, and I had a certain structure. I mean, they were elaborated upon and extended a little bit, but you know, they existed as pre-configured ideas. Whereas with the previous version of Swans, I might write something on acoustic guitar, but it was with the full understanding that with this tremendous group of individuals with whom I was working, things would morph. And just by dint of the fact that it was a ensemble that had its own consciousness almost, and so things would change over time and through performance. So a thing, a song, or an idea that I might have written, and it was 2 or 3 minutes long, ended up being a 35-minute piece. Sometimes live, the pieces were 50 minutes long. It was a whole different way of approaching music. It was a very committed physical enterprise, and it was kind of a group psychic workout to perform the material. Whereas this, you know, they're songs, and I just took, like I mentioned earlier, I just approached them as a producer, and hopefully to achieve some kind of cinematic quality to the material.
I would imagine now you have been with this album using musicians that are, you know, for lack of a better word, curated over the history of your art. It may be difficult to go to a second.
I should interject that I have some salient contributors on this record with whom I haven't worked before. Mm. Anna and Maria von Hauswolfer add tremendously to the record. You mentioned the choral vocals. Mm-hmm. Anna von Hauswolfer was a great singer, artist, and her sister Maria is a cinematographer, but she also sings with her sometimes. And I heard their voices together at a show that Anna was doing with Swans. She was the, I guess, opener. And I was just enthralled with how great their voices sounded together. So I asked them to perform. I was kind of inspired on one song, It's Coming, It's Real, by this great Odetta song that I heard, which was just a double bass and a full gospel choir. And it just had this tremendous, I don't know, I can't use technical terms. I want to say the overtones, but it really just sounded like the voices of sorrow just lifting up into hope and taking you to heaven. And there was this kind of perception I had that I might achieve something else using a similar notion. So I got Anna Maria to multi-track all these vocals and around my song. And also on the record are the group from down your way, the Necks, mm-hmm. whom I view as being the Beatles, basically. I just think they're so great. And to have them on my record is just, I don't know, it's like a dream come true. So I was really pleased to have them. I think they're just tremendous, both live and on record. I sent them some very simple versions of the songs and just asked them to perform. I didn't really give them any direction. I just figured it would be fine because this color that would be achieved would be the Next. And it worked out great. And also I have Ben Frost on the record, with whom I haven't worked before. He's also from Australia originally, isn't he? Ben is I guess he's known as an electronic musician, but he's really a composer and just a great all-around musician, and he contributed to great effect. And then I have the Chanteuse, Baby D, for whom I wrote a song. So and I've never recorded with Baby D before, although we've performed on the same stage several times. So there you go.
Yeah, quite a few Australians. Yeah. Very good.
It seems so. Yeah, I didn't realize until just now.
Now, it sounds like you reach out to musicians to collaborate. You'll hear something here or there. You'll come across an artist and want to do collaboration. Do you also have artists reaching out to you?
No. Okay. Someone just approached me to contribute to their music. And I won't say whom, but I tried. and it didn't work out, and so we just canceled the idea. Okay. I'm not really. I'm a very particular kind of musician in that I can just play my own songs. I don't really translate into other worlds very well.
But I would imagine, yeah, you would have some people that would want to collaborate, but that
yes, I collaborate. I mean, but I'm the director, you know, so I guess I'm uncomfortable not being the director in something I'm involved in.
Would you classify yourself as a bit of a, well, I'll use the term control freak, but I don't mean it to be that, that
harsh. No, I'm an artist, yeah. You know. I'm an artist. It's my work. So it's not really being a control freak. It's just I have, for lack of a better word, a vision. And so things that come into that endeavor need to contribute to it. And it's not – I mean, it's when I'm sitting in a room playing with people, it sort of just gestates and comes. But I'm always – making comments and trying to guide it in a certain direction. So, I mean, you don't want to hamper people, but I mean, the people I work with actually, now that I mentioned it, they know, they just intuitively know what needs to be done to serve the song. So there you go.
For example, when you're working with, you're getting ready to develop album art, do you give Phil Puglio specific guidance on what you're thinking, or does he come with things, a few choices?
No, I'm the art director.
Okay. So for To Be Kind, you said, you know what would be great on the cover? A crying baby.
Well, no, I mean, I those images are extracted from paintings by an artist named Bob Biggs. And I had seen those paintings back in Los Angeles in 1977 or something. They're actually painted on black velvet. And I had always wanted to use those images. And when To Be Kind came about, for some reason, I thought of it again. And I contacted him, and he finally agreed to let me do it. He hadn't before. And I asked his permission, but I cut out, not physically, but in Photoshop, I cut out the baby's heads and then placed them on the cardboard. So... That's how that came about.
Ah, so you roll up your sleeves and get right into Photoshop too.
No, I don't do the physical thing. Oh, okay. I just tell someone what to do. Just like in a studio, I have no idea how to use Pro Tools, but I know what it does, and I just kind of direct things.
So going back to your youth, what were some of the records that really got you interested in making music?
Well, there's a big distinction because I listened to records assiduously, as, you know, I guess most young people do. In my time, say when I was 12, 13, was the 60s. And so the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, but I think a pivotal group to me, and it kind of remains in the back of my head, is the Doors. Being from California and having been an aficionado of psychedelics, they fit right into the whole kind of, what's the word, sunny apocalypse of California at the time. And, you know, their music was a kind of cinematic experience, you know, really, when you look at it. And I guess that has translated into an aesthetic that I employ sometimes. You know, songs like The End or When the Music's Over are just, you know, they're a total experience and a tremendous landmarks in popular music, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. And by the way, parenthetically, I would say that Robbie Krieger, is it Krieger or Kruger? The guitar player.
Krieger, I thought, maybe. I don't know.
Krieger?
A few different ways.
Is probably one of the handful of best rock guitarists ever. I think it's just fantastic. He played with his fingers. He played... you know, picking. He didn't use a plectrum. Oh. But his, you know, his kind of raga style that he uses in, say, The End is just beautiful. It's really good. His guitar playing is amazing. But that's looking at it in hindsight now with some kind of musical vocabulary. But at the time, they were just a great experience. When I, you know, started thinking about music, punk rock was happening. And, I was in art school, and I was sort of increasingly had some trepidation with the world of art. Not art. I love art, but I didn't feel comfortable with the profession of being an artist in the modern age very much. And I thought that the punk rock that was happening was kind of spoke more to the moment in this unfolding consumer corporate culture that was, you know, becoming pretty apparent at that time. Now it's, of course, 1,000% worse. But I thought that just the way that punk kind of ingested the consumerist slogans and advertising and identities and the way and chewed it up and spit it back at you in a very kind of ugly fashion was really pertinent to modern life, much more than a kind of sequestered or particularized art world. So I gravitated towards that. And I guess the bands that would have interested me at the time were Suicide and earlier music, but the Stooges interested me. And I guess Wire I thought was kind of inspirational too. Also art students who didn't know how to play their instruments at all before they started a band and just made something happen and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed their songs and became obviously incredibly proficient at playing what they did on their own terms and made some really great sonic events happen. Also of influence in the early days was what's now termed as the no wave, for similar reasons, in that this was people just picking up instruments with varying degrees of skill and just spewing out their emotions with these instruments as non-musicians. And that to me was inspirational, being a non-musician. And I just started making shit happen that way.
What did you like about it? Was it the impulsiveness of it, the naivety? Like, what was...
violence. Yeah. that was, to me, this is just a facet of the times, but the more extreme and the more violent something was, the more attractive it was to me.
What is some music that you listen to these days?
Not much. My ears have reached kind of maximum overload. But I can, let me see, I'll just pull up my iTunes here. Here in my catalog is Desert Shore, The End, and Marvel Index by Nico. I have a tremendous Odetta live record. I have a plethora of albums here by The Necks. I have Meredith Monk. I have, let me see what else I got here. Sort of a peppering of Led Zeppelin thrown in. John Fahey, Keith Jarrett, John Coltrane, John Cale. Soundtrack to the recent television series Chernobyl, which I thought was really excellent.
Oh my God, that was incredible, wasn't it?
Yes, she's a great composer. She's really good.
She also did the soundtrack to the Joker movie, I believe, too.
Yeah, I haven't seen that or heard it. I don't know. What else have I got here? Les Mystères des Voix Bulgares. That's Bulgarian folk music that came out in the 80s. I remember hearing it then. Charlemagne Palestine, great musician. I don't know if you know his music. He's kind of loosely termed a minimalist composer. But he plays piano. He'll play repetitive figures on a piano with such intensity that the piano emits these choirs of angels at a certain point. And it's very, very beautiful. I'd say I have Brian Eno, of course. Lots of Brian Eno. Aretha Franklin.
have you heard the band Go-Go Penguin?
No, I have not.
Yeah, because they do a lot of repetitive passages, and they get the similar kind of overtones on the top, and they're quite interesting. Go-Go Penguin, check them out. I just discovered them. They're on Blue Note Records.
Oh. Well, you know, one thing about Charlemagne and Palestine is these overtones and harmonics that he was obsessed with, I suppose, were hugely influential on Rhys Chatham and Glenn Branca. Mm. And they ended up, Glenn did, he ended up composing for the harmonic series so that he would have lots of guitars and these kind of dulcimer-like instruments that he would build playing repetitive notes. But he was composing not for the percussion of the notes, but for the overtones that would occur. Mm-hmm. And he made some incredible music. And the final artist of note here in my collection is, of course, the wonderful Alice Coltrane. There was a record released by, I forget the title of the record company, but David Byrne's record label. He released these cassette recordings of music that was recorded in her ashram, this devotional music in, I guess, the 70s or 80s. And it's a lot of chanting vocals and it's a strong gospel element to it as well. And it's really transcendent and kind of beautiful.
Are you in a constant state of creation? Is that something that you do every day? Does it come in bursts?
I think bursts is too emphatic a term. It comes through slow agglomeration of ideas. But I need time by myself to work. And when I'm on tour, nothing happens. Hmm. When I'm at home, first thing I do is sit at my desk, pick up the guitar and open the computer and a Word program and try to write. But it does not come easily. Eventually, something happens and then I'm elated, but it's a long process.
When you're traveling, for this right now, are there clippets or passages or things that you try to grab onto and hold on so when you do have time that can germinate and maybe turn into something bigger?
I write in my journal pretty much every day and will write down ideas, but I've never been able to write on tour. I'm too distracted, mm-hmm. and kind of always nervous waiting to go on stage, even if it's 2 days from now.
Is there an activity or a state of being in which you allow yourself to be the most creative?
No, it's much more banal than that. It's just sitting down and working, and then eventually something happens and you're transported. But it just takes work and practice and persistence.
So it's discipline as well. You're like, okay, I'm going to shut off the phone and get everyone out of my life today. And you put yourself in
that situation. Yeah, well, it's just a personal proclivity, but I don't really feel like I'm worth much unless I'm making something. So it's just the way it is.
When you write, what comes first, words or music or?
Generally the music, 90% of the time. I'll have a chord or two I play on the guitar and I'll sing, you know, like Scrambled Eggs, like Paul McCartney or something. And then eventually an image will appear and then I'll grab onto that image and that image implies other images or a story, a narrative, and something happens. I rarely sit down trying to write about a subject. It's the subject reveals itself as I write.
And do you find yourself surprised by where you go during this process?
Yeah, I mean, the song My Phantom Limb was a surprise. That sort of came all at once. And, I don't want to give away the germ that from which that song grew, but there was just an image that appeared of a person I know who's dying. And I started writing about them and then it developed into what it is.
Do you try to avoid sharing the origin of some of this material, trying not to be too revealing?
Well, yeah, and it's not trying to be mysterious or mystical or something. It's because I think once you start explicating or analyzing art to such a degree that all the questions are answered, the friction that is created between, say in the case of a painting, between the viewer and the painting, is lost. You can say, oh, well, this person is dealing with the issues of such and such. Okay, next. To me, the interesting thing is the tension between the thing, the art, and the person that's experiencing it. Is the kind of state of mind that's created while trying to parse but also experience the thing. That's what's important.
Yeah, because people will view the art through their own keyhole of their own experience, and
yeah, but you know, the art should have I'm looking at, see, I mean, if you look at a painting by Van Eyck, right, there's one of the, there's, which one is the triptych, the Ghent altarpiece, I think, it's just so god, it's like the culmination of all human potential in one work, but it's a psychedelic experience, really. But I'm sure that there's lots of ways that you could describe it and put it in a historical context and talk about the aesthetics of the time and all that, but that kind of belies the fact of the experience of the thing itself.
You don't want to be too heavy-handed or prescriptive about it. You want people to find their meaning.
Yeah, I mean, it kills the experience.
Do your words typically come from a stream of consciousness? Do you go back and do many rewrites?
Oh, I rewrite all the time. For instance, I brought up My Phantom Limb. That, I believe, wrote itself pretty quickly. There's a lot of revisions, but generally it's like building a wall with grains of sand, you know? Mm. It's with tweezers. It's very slow for me. I'm not an eruptive person when it comes to writing. It doesn't just happen. So it just grows. One thing means another thing, means another thing.
People spend a lot of time with your work analyzing it and looking for clues, deeper meanings. And I guess it appears you encourage that.
I don't know. I mean, they may or may not be there, but that's their business. I make the work, and then it's kind of out of my hands.
Is it interesting to you, or even amusing, to see someone interpret it very differently than what you know the origin to be?
I just did an interview a minute ago with someone who brought up a song. I won't mention the song, but and they said what people are saying about it, like what it means, in this really kind of quotidian, really banal way, and I just thought, God, that is incredibly stupid. So I don't know, but you know, I mean, I'm really, I feel privileged. Like, for instance, I did a concert last night, and just when people, I go out to the merch table after the shows and meet people always, and just to see people that, it's not like, oh, Michael, you're great, you know, or anything like that. That doesn't interest me. But when people tell me that the music has given them some kind of anchor or has provided a meaningful experience for them, that to me feels like I've done something worthwhile.
The way that Young God Records operates is quite interesting. You've got a dedicated number of people around the world who enjoy your music, enjoy your art so much that they commit, they buy to whatever you're selling sight unseen. I mean, that's got to be tremendously satisfying as an artist, yeah?
Indeed. I mean, I made that happen myself, though. I formed a label in 1989, and it was in the early 2000s that we started involving supporters of the music. I'll use that word rather than fans. In the production of the music. I don't mean aesthetically, but I started releasing handmade CDs, incredibly laboriously produced artwork, and offering them for sale in order to raise the money to be able to record a record that kind of suited the vision that I had for its production. So the record sales base does not justify the amount of money I spend on recording, that's for sure. And so people are able to participate in helping to bring it to fruition. And that's again, that's something that I feel very grateful for. But I just thought, you know, fuck all this advertising, you know, and promotion, and just reach the people who care about it. And then you can continue to work. So that's what I did, starting in, I think, 2000 or something.
You even give people a peek behind the music. Like, for instance, for Leaving Meaning, you allowed people to support you by getting a CD of the demos several months prior. That's a very interesting way to work, because you're being quite vulnerable at that point as well. Is that uncomfortable in any way?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's not like I'm going to be crucified. I mean, it's one stage of the song. And then the song is recorded, and then it's going to be performed live, and it'll be completely different then too. So it's just a step along the way. And I thought, why not? Just let people see how it starts. And those songs, as they were performed on that CD that I sold to raise the money for the recording of this, that's pretty much what they sound like sitting alone at my desk in my room. I thought, that's fine. And then that's the seed from which the music then grows into something else. I've done things like offer to write songs about people for a certain amount of money contributed to the recording. So I don't remember how many people it was, maybe 25 or 30. I wrote each of them a song about them.
Wow. Okay.
And I also did drawings. I did drawings of people. They send me a photograph and I would do a drawing of them and send them that.
So I could actually get a song about my wife.
Yeah, you know, but not now. I've done it. I won't do it again.
Oh, okay.
But, and, you know, they were admittedly humorous. You know, I just punned on words around their name and imagined who they were and wrote these songs very quickly.
Okay. How about my voicemail message? Would you be able to do that?
I would be able to, but I would not.
Look, I imagine you're going to continue to create as long as you continue to breathe. Is there something you still want to achieve? Is there still kind of a stone that hasn't been turned over yet, or a dream you'd like to see become reality?
Yeah, making a great record. I'd like to make a great record at some point.
are you hard on yourself in that case?
Yeah, I don't want to deflate the music for people that get something from it, but I just, everything to me is a huge failure. I'm just always looking for the thing that's just going to be this undeniable experience that I am unable to pick apart. But everything that I've done, I can hear everything that's wrong with it. And it always it bothers me if I go back and listen to things.
If you had to look back on your catalog, what is the moment that you're most proud of?
None of it.
There's nothing that just kind of bumps above the rest?
Well, no. But the period that just ended from 2010 to 2017 was, for me personally, a high point because the music was forming itself alive and breathing constantly for that period of time with a steady group of people, which was a first. Almost every group that I formed disbanded within a year or something, and a new group formed after that throughout the career of Swans. I mean, people would stay for a while. Norman stayed for quite some time, Jarboe, of course, but the personnel was constantly changing. And it was good to have a group of people upon whom I could rely and to be able to fall into the situation, and the music would just take, literally, I mean, it just felt like, anyway, like it took on its own life in live performances and really played us, and not the reverse. Mm-hmm. And it was a great experience. To me, it was an apogee of the career. Now, I don't know how the records translate in that way, but it really felt great.
Mm. So you don't listen to any of your music after it's recorded? In fact, it sounds like you want to get far away from it.
Yeah, I mean, every once in a while, of course, when I have to remaster something, I have to get involved in it. And it's usually kind of an adventure in acute depression.
Consistent wincing.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't know. I've learned to just not go there and just think about what's next.
Are you happy?
Personally?
Yes.
Oh, well, that's not really a fair question, but I'm curious. I'm still trying to understand what the hell I am and this world is and why the hell I'm here. And I think that's about as much as anyone could ask for.
Well, Michael, I really want to thank you for coming on the show. And believe me, it's my distinct pleasure for you to have spent some time with me and our audience. I do want to share with people as well, there is a new Swans LP, Leaving Meaning. Michael may not be happy with it, but I certainly am. And I think a lot of people out there will as well. It's available at younggodrecords.com. There's a limited number of them, and then they'll go out of print. So get a copy, sit back and listen to it and enjoy it. It's on vinyl as well. Turn your phone off, turn your attention to the music, and enjoy the ride.
Thank you very much, Nate.
Right, there we are, Michael Girard. Thank you, Michael, for coming on the show. Again, I want to remind everyone to go to younggodrecords.com and get one of those pre-order vinyl sets for Leaving Meaning. Limited numbers, $25 for a two-record set that comes with a poster, insert, and autographed. That's quite a bargain. Younggodrecords.com. Also, a huge thank you shout out to friend of the show, Blake Yeager, who spent quite a bit of time helping me prepare for this interview. Thank you so much, Blake. Much appreciated. And that is it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. Again, please share this episode with your friends, your enemies, your uncles, your aunts, whoever. Put it on Facebook, Instagram, tweet it out. Do whatever you can to help spread the word on The Vinyl Guide podcast. I do appreciate it, and we hope to be back next week with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.